I originally started to write a speech, and then it fizzled out, and I wrote notes. So I will read the speech, and then I will go into the notes. I've always been fascinated by maps, and for all my life, I've loved to draw. I draw generally cities. That is, I start with a blank piece of paper with perhaps a few rivers or lakes indicated on it, then create a couple of strategic roads in an intersection near a lake or river, and then go from there. First, there's a fort or a trading place, and then there are more houses and roads, wharves, canals, tombs of kings, shops, warehouses, palaces, universities, sports stadiums, houses, airports, railway stations. Some maps I've spent hundreds of hours on, watching them grow until I've created a city or even cities with hundreds, thousands of buildings, roads and highways, and eventually even canals or redirected rivers. It's a great time waster, but it's also therapeutic, something I can easily get lost in. And when I've actually visited alien places outside my own previous experience, I bring that new knowledge and insight back to my drawings. In Oxford, England, I was especially taken with the juxtaposition of the narrow streets and colleges with, a few minutes away, a carefully cultivated sense of openness, wildness, and the outdoors. The quadrangles of Yale University in New Haven brought home to me the possibilities of separating students and their needs for quiet study, contemplation, a feeling of apartness from the louder traffic of the streets. The high streets of so much of England are in their own commercial way unique to the old world. So I've used that experience, that insight into the creation of places and how people and buildings interact to form cities and community life, to go back and put that knowledge, that expansion of my sense of civilization's design, to use in my own artwork and designs. For all my life, I've drawn maps of places that didn't exist outside my head, with those cities and roads and highways and airports and bridges, which on paper appears a thin line or two if you're looking down on the Firth of Forth bridges, and exist as vast projects achieved with great ambition, the blood and sweat and inspiration of thousands, but only in my own mind, spanning vast distances, linking islands and crossing rivers. Those thin lines and little squares and rectangles spring forth from the paper when I and I alone look at it as this sort of invisible megalopolis, much like a good road map can show you towering mountains, lakes, and expressways, if it's done right. I've been fascinated by, continue to be fascinated by water, which has a sound we all enjoy. How else to explain the universal use of fountains and waterfalls in so many places in our cities, and the appearance of fountains everywhere, in every climate, everywhere. Fountains and the sound of running water evoke a feeling and image in all of us, no matter how far from the sea we live, that no matter what our cultural backgrounds, resonates within all of us. I have this addiction for fountains and water. I have to admit I may be the only, one of the few people, and certainly almost the only fan in New York who has a fountain in their apartment, complete with a very small waterfall, a very small waterfall, a couple of pools of water and the sound of falling water when I turn on the pump. So having drawn maps from the age of 8 or 9, maps in which canals, channels, and the interaction of water and land, tides and tidal pools, cities and ports and wharves play so great a part, it's somehow right I'm here now in The Hague, a city like so many others in this country where precisely the same sort of thing has shaped the land and the people. This is one of the very few countries where the mastery of land over water is asserted so forcefully, perhaps only in Bangladesh, which so far has failed so miserably to conquer the vast forces mustered by the weather, with tidal bores sweeping away the lives and livings of thousands, has so much thought been bent toward control of the oceans. Here in the Netherlands, which in itself is a name to conjure with, they've succeeded for the short term, a few hundred, a thousand years certainly, while other forces are mustered. I have little doubt that a long fight is starting with the greenhouse effect and the general subsidence of the area around the North Sea on one hand, and the forces of human imagination and engineering, and perhaps even desperation on the other, for domination between water and land right here around us. We'll all be gone when the final battles are joined if we don't kill each other off in the near future, but our descendants hopefully will master the waves. Tractor beams holding back the waters, vast molecular dams impervious to physical forces, genetic adaptions of seaweed forming impenetrable coastal mats, mutated otters tending the barricades, the thoughts, the possibilities are endless. Curiously, that interaction of wave and shore has to some extent shaped us as well. I'm talking about the so many novels and stories about water, flood, continents singing and rising from Atlantis to John Wyndham's picture of London slowly submerging in Art of the Deeps, or John Bowen's The Tide Went Out, works by Piers Anthony, J.G. Ballard, Arthur C. Clarke, and C.J. Cherry with water, and the lack thereof or the overabundance of its central theme. Waves come in and go out. Tidal forces have shaped the earth, and tidal forces have shaped SF and fandom. The forces of society and commercial manipulation have come together to create the SF field we know. Commercial pulp magazines with their lurid covers and action writing shaped early fandom. Peer pressure and pressure from parents to stop reading that stuff, forced together like-minded protofans. We gathered together against the barbarians, first in the letter columns of the SF magazines, then in clubs and our own genzines, our own fanzines, and last in conventions where we could get together and create a gestalt. All right, now here's the part where I go into my notes and I wing it. All right. The forces that created fandom were these terrible, lurid covers, and people who read it, who caught that imagination, read this stuff and hid the covers away, and they hid them under newspapers and stuff. And then we started writing to each other, and we gathered together in these fan clubs, and we started writing to each other, and we published fanzines, and we created this group, this feeling that we were a community united against everyone outside of us. And that was pretty much generated and maintained up through the 1950s and into the 1960s. And then came a sudden realization from the commercial forces that did SF, that published the SF, that when Star Wars came along, that perhaps there were millions of people out there who might read SF. And it led to a growing commercialization of science fiction. People like Jude Lynn Del Rey, who was a great marketing force, a powerful person who changed the face of science fiction as we know it. And she created a genre, a commercial genre that could get on the New York Times bestseller list. What happened, unfortunately, is that this has profoundly affected science fiction fandom. And there is, in these days, in this modern time, there's a wider acceptance of bizarre behavior, punks and things like that, and people with, you know, mohawk haircuts and things, which were strange appearances only in science fiction, are suddenly acceptable in the real world. At the same time, there are lots more conventions, and there's a fracturing of science fiction fandom into smaller groups. There's media fans, and within media fans, there are other groups. There are Star Trek fans, and there are Doctor Who fans, and Prisoner fans, and all sorts of things. And within science fiction itself, there are more groups. There are gaming fans, and fantasy fans, and filking fans, and things like that. So we have all these other groups rising from what we thought of as the central fandom, which was fanzine fandom originally. And fanzine fandom has now dwindled to form a group which is now allocated the fan lounge or the fanzine lounge or the fan repro rooms. And we have moved off. I thought what originally was the mainstream fandom has now become this one narrow branch. We are like, still think of ourselves as the chosen people, but to everyone else, we're just a sort of a, you know, a strange cult religion off on the side of things. All right, I think there's no center to fandom anymore, and the result is there's no gathering point, and there's no focus to fandom. And as conventions continue, they are becoming more commercial, and they're of less interest to hardcore SF fans, especially things like these creation conventions where they are created, these conventions, simply to make a buck, simply to make a profit. They don't have memberships. You don't have memberships in these conventions you attend. You buy a ticket. They don't have badges. They stamp your hand to make sure that you can't sneak in again without paying. They give you less and less. At the same time, you have the rise of the TV generation, people who are expected to be entertained, people who don't want to participate in programming. You look at people, and I've seen filming, I've seen people taping parts of conventions, and if you look at the people behind that, they will be looking at the screen, and the image on the screen is of more importance to them than the real-life image out in front of them of the people talking. It's just a bizarre thing, but it's a sort of TV generation. There are also conventions that are growing just because they can. Things like BossCon, which each division said, yes, we can do this and we will do more and better things next year, until finally we have 4,000, 5,000 people at a regional convention. And the result of that is that you have a lot of bad things happening at conventions. You have all the people who decide, well, you know, for $20 we can go to this convention and they'll feed us free food, they'll feed us free beer, and 24 hours a day of programming and all sorts of films and videos and gaming and this and that, And if we happen to wreck the hotel while it's there, hey, it's there for us to use it. So I think there are very bad things happening to fandom and to conventions. And I think some of these bad things are cutting off the source, the lifeblood that has been feeding in and generating new fans and generating an interest in a sustained interest in fandom. We have now a lot of conventions where they are banning people under 18 years of age from attending conventions, or even 21 years of age. And yet, up until 10 or 15 years ago, 90% of the people attending the conventions were under 18 or 21. They were teenagers and stuff. So you've got these people, and they're cutting off this source of income for the convention and for fandom. People who first attended conventions and then went on, perhaps, to learn that there were fans in their own hometowns and neighborhoods. And then they got in touch with these fans at the convention, or they got in touch afterwards. And then they joined fandom and did things that, you know, and became part of fandom and learned about fanzines and stuff like that. And you've cut off this river coming in, this river of fans coming in. There are other things, too. There are the fact that conventions are run by those only, they're run by volunteers, those willing to work on them. And by cutting off this income of fans, you cut off people willing to work on them. The average age of people working on conventions is just older. We're all sort of, we're getting middle class. I mean, I'm looking out in this audience now, and I know a lot of you people. And a lot of you ain't young anymore. There's an awful lot of white hair and balding heads and stuff in here. All of us who have started out with nice bright red beards, and now they're all kind of grayish. They're all getting older. The people willing to work on these conventions are getting older, and yet the stress to put on these conventions is actually much greater than it's ever been before. And there are things like insurance now. A lot of things can't be done because you have to have insurance to cover it. And the insurance is so expensive to cover problems with people falling down and tripping, or people forgetting to take drugs that they're taking, that you can't do these things. And there are limits to the things that all conventions can offer now. They're so big that the IRS is attracted to conventions in the US, so that you have the IRS coming in and seizing goods that are in violation of copyrights and things. You have sales tax people coming in. You have workers' compensation people coming and saying, well, you have these people working for free, and yet you have to provide for them. You're legally responsible for them. There are many bad things going on. There are also rising hotel prices. My first WorldCon, my mother didn't want me to spend the $6 a night, I think it was, for a room. So I stayed at the Y across town. The 1967 WorldCon, the rooms were, I believe, $9 singles and $14 for doubles. That same hotel now, recently, they had a special rate of $99 a night. The conventions are just more expensive to go to. But we're making a lot more money because we used to be all students, and we used to go, you know, 20 people in a car going out to a convention, you know, now, and then eventually buses, and now we all just get our Super Savers, and we've got our Marriott points and our TWA points and stuff, and we go out to these conventions. We're making good money now. There are a lot of other things happening, though, which is means that all this is starting to come to an end. Conventions, sales conventions, mundane, what we call mundane conventions, are increasingly under a cost. The prices are going up for going to conventions, for mundanes as well as for SF fans. And more mundane conventions are being held on weekends when we have usually the hotels and the cheap rates, so that there is now more competition for these conventions space, the space that we have the conventions in. And there's competition from these commercial places that say, sure, 4 years away from now, sure, we'll book your facilities. I mean, this has happened in Nashville as dead as a bid because the Opryland Hotel had another group come in and say, well, you know, you want to bid for the WorldCon, but we have this group which is willing to pay us cold cash now for this space 3 or 4 years in advance. The same thing happened to Washington, D.C. for their bid. B'nai B'rith came in and said, sure, we want the space 3 years in advance, no problem. Here's our $20,000 deposit. And we lost it, and they lost the bid, and we're not going to be there. I think the eventual result of people growing older and far fewer fans coming in and less of this in-group feeling from the result of more commercialization of science fiction is that there are just going to be a lot less fans. We have sort of a bell curve, and we're way past the middle of the bell curve. We're going down. It's sort of a dwindling process. The peak buying years of fandom are pretty much now or starting to be over. We're all in our starting to become middle-aged. Our incomes are at their peak. I mean, what happens when you're 65 and the choice is between going to a convention or saving for the fact that you may need your medical insurance, you're worried about it running out? You're going to skip the convention and you're not going to go. So let me read my notes a little bit. Also, fans have always had a larger than proportionate pressure on professionals. We've exerted far more influence than our numbers dictate. The awards have done this, certainly the Hugos and stuff. The last year or so, there's been a big fall off on the number of nominations and votes for the Hugos, which so far hasn't been explained. But I think it's part of this thing with the cost of conventions. And of course, there's a recession started in the East and various parts of the country, in the US, and I think that will also affect conventions. BossCon had a big fall off in attendance, and they said, well, it's the year after the WorldCon, so it's okay, but what happens next year? Be interesting to see what happens in February if instead of 1,500 people, they only have 600 people at the convention. A lot of people in Nesva are out of work. All these people working for computer places and stuff, bam, suddenly they get laid off. They had these great jobs, and they had great incomes and stuff. And recession hits, and they don't have the money coming in. They have to take a lesser-paying job. All right, there are other bizarre things happening. Mimeo and Ditto were once the glue that held fanzine fandom together. The passing into history of Ditto and Mimeograph, things are happening to fanzines that are changing them utterly. Desktop publishing is rising, but it's very expensive. It's possible that fanzine fandom will evolve into sort of a network things with bulletin boards and the use of computers. Used to be you could go down to Sears and buy a hectograph for $15, you could buy a mimeograph for $75, a tube of ink, some stencils and stuff, some cheap mimeo paper. They don't make the cheap mimeo paper anymore, they make paper for offset and for copiers. The mimeos, well, actually, the mimeos are cheaper than ever now because they're not making them anymore and people are dumping them left and right. People who bought electro-stenciling machines for $1,500 or $2,000, you can get them for $25 now because no one wants them except as a means of generating ozone, I guess, for the ozone layer. You can pick up mimeos very cheaply now because no one wants them. They all want photocopiers. This is just ancient technology. It's like 100 years of mimeography. About 1880 to 1980, and then down, it's going out. But the cost of these new things that replace them is very expensive. Laser printers, all right, they're getting cheaper, but still it's a much more expensive hobby than it was. And for people who wanted to publish what we call a crudzine, you can't publish, actually, it's you can't publish a crudzine anymore because the computers now make them look so good that the definition of crudzine has changed. So it used to be that you'd get this really cruddy looking fanzine. It would look terrible, and the mimeo ink would be terrible, and the type would run off the bottom of the page, and it didn't say anything. Well, now it's impeccably reproduced, but it still doesn't say anything. So you actually have to read the thing to learn that it's terrible. It's kind of bizarre. All right, we've got bulletin boards for computers. Fans can go to these bulletin boards and talk to other fans. But it's different. It's not the fandom that we had, and so it will eventually perhaps evolve into something else. It won't be this close-knit thing. It'll be only through impersonal communication over vast distances. People writing to each other in real time or writing stuff and then sending it over their modems and things like that. It's just an evolution, I think, of fandom. But it's an evolution into something which will not be this fandom. And to those of us familiar with this fandom, it won't be of interest. And to those people who have gotten into this from scratch and right from left field, this fandom to them will be utterly bizarre and of no interest. All right, the question is, do we want to see fandom wither and die? Are we willing to hold on to what we have now? There's a big effort required to maintain this status quo, to go against the stream of time and a changing society. It's possible that fandom, and I think is what is happening to it, and will be happening to it, is that we will become a quaint and very small group. You know, like, hey, the Shakers were really big, but of course, you know, they didn't reproduce, folks. The Shaker religion called for no sex. So all the people who became Shakers were converted. And once they dwindled away, what they left behind was some very nice architecture and some very nice design and some furniture. And I think, what, there are four or five Shakers left in the world, and that's it. But it's dead. You know, it's a footnote in history, and history of religion and the history of American fandom and the history of American civilization. There are also, as I said, tighter business conditions in which business meetings are moving into weekends, which were traditionally a time when fans could get convention space for less than market rates. Fans will be competing with commercial forces for hotel and convention space, and then we will be out in the cold because we cannot compete commercially. At the same time, as we dwindle and as our purchasing power dwindles, we have less and less connection to commercial SF, which is this, you know, sharecropping, you know, Joe Schmo writing in the universe of Isaac Asimov's Winds of War, something like that, you know, Volume 7, The Final Confrontation, or maybe not, you know, to be continued. Commercial SF is changing and becoming very general commercial genre. It's not the thing that we've had before. It's not the feeling we've had before of, you know, I mean, look at the 1950s list of Ballantine books when every single month had titles which have come out and become classics. You can look at every single month of Ballantine books from the early 50s, and almost every single one of those books is now a classic. We have so much stuff, so much product is coming out, as we call it, product. And we don't read all that stuff anymore. A lot of it's crap. You know, Sturgeon's Law with 90% of everything is crap. Well, now it's up at about 97% is crap. And I think it's rising, you know, SF and fantasy and everything else, you know. Terry Brooks writing in the world of J.R.R. Tolkien's, you know, Lord of the Rings, yeah. Hey, it gets on the New York Times bestseller list and it's commercial bestseller, but we don't want to read that stuff. All right. So, the final result is that fan publishing can continue the way it is now and change to something utterly bizarre, and then we can all retire to the old fans' retired home, the Tucker Hotel, which never got built, and now is too expensive to be built, or we can change along with it. The question is, will the rise of computer nets eventually make fandom into just another means of communicating and thus losing it? Will the graying of fandom cause a market downturn in the numbers of those in fandom and the number able and willing to go to conventions? The question is, what can we do about it? And another question is, what should we do? Do we want to do anything about it? Or the question is, are those forces outside or beyond our control? And I think these are questions which we have to address now before it's really too late to do anything. We should make perhaps a concerted effort to draw in younger people into fandom. Possibly, I know Nesfa now is talking about reprinting some old James H. Schmidt's novels, which are out of print because they weren't commercial enough to stay in print. Are these things which we can do to sort of save fandom as we've known and loved it? Or is it just too late for us and we're just sort of destined to become dodos and dwindling dinosaurs and, you know, Spanish-American war veterans meet last three, you know, Spanish-American War veterans meeting somewhere, and aren't they weird and strange? And look at those old guys, and isn't it amazing to be 103 and still alive in your wheelchair with your, you know, artificial respirator? That could be us, folks, another 15 or 20 years. That's it. Bummer, wasn't it? And my thing here says, lastly, take questions from audience. Give me questions. Yes, Mr. Fetter.
Don't you think it's our responsibility as forward-looking...
fans or slams, yes.
Right, science fiction fans who are supposed to be prepared for the idea of change, accepting change, to find some way to accommodate ourselves to the changes that you're projecting?
Well, fandom, I think, is friendships. And we are friends with less and less people. The people slowly gaffate, and, you know, it's like, gee, all these friends of yours are dying, and then suddenly it's your turn, you know. But by then you're dead and you don't know.
It's a natural process.
It's a natural process. Yeah. So I think that fandom is sort of a transitory 20th century thing. We are aware that it's a transitory 20th century thing. The question is, do we want it to be? Do we want to sustain it? Can we sustain it? Should we sustain it?
It'd be a fake fan that sustains it artificially.
Well,
the things that made it unique.
Fans with three or four A's were people who don't read SF. Well, I think maybe fandom will eventually evolve into that direction. We will be the people who don't read SF.
They're about 20, 30 years ahead of us.
All right, yeah, first fandom is, you know, let's all go to the meetings and who died since last meeting.
Yeah, one thing that interests me is how to make computer bulletin boards more, I guess, just fanish, for want of a better word. For example, some sort of self-regulating mechanisms, like where you charge per word you put on or per word you read, even just funny money. Because the problem now is that you get two kinds of reply. Either you get people rush right to the keyboard as soon as they reach something and dash it off without any thought. 50 people say exactly the same thing, it's all not worth it at all. Or people say, well, I can answer it any time, I'll get to it, and never
happens. That's right, engage brain before mouth is open.
Right. Yeah. Whereas the other extreme is people say, well, I can do it any time, you know, and they put it there to gather dust for the next 2 years. Whereas, well, I do a conventional app, and when you have an app, you have the deadlines that encourage you to say, okay, deadline is coming up, I really need to sit down here and not put it off anymore. But also, when you first get it, you know, deadline isn't for a few more weeks yet, so I just said, think about it before I have to. I think there may be some way to build
but
the mechanisms into rules into it.
Do we want to do it like that? I mean, do we want to go away from this, the printed word? People always talk about, gee, we've got this great, you know, computer now, and you can just scribble into it, and it'll recognize your writing, and take notes, and people say, yeah, I've heard that's called a notebook or a book, you know, and a pencil. That's this, you know, input device called the pencil.
The problem is printing.
It's printing. Do we want to print? Will we reach a point where paper is so valuable, and the trees that paper, or the things that paper is made from is so valuable, that we will go to a true paperless society? What happens to artwork?
Andy, the basis of science fiction fandom was the magazine business. It was a means of communication, and people talked about the ideas and the stories. And it was magazines knit everybody together. The disappearance of magazines, essentially,
yeah.
The disappearance of the reader's column, essentially, there isn't the computer world is kind of filling in that gap, but it hasn't that same relationship where printed letters were disseminated to everybody who read the magazine. So it's a new world.
So it is. We've sort of split off into this little, we have become a closed loop, a closed universe, which is some coming to an end, traveling off through infinity.
Magazine create a lot of discussion and interest. So I think it's a It's an insurmountable problem.
Is it possible to urge the magazines to have letter columns in which the stories are discussed and publish, always publish the addresses of the letter writers?
You brought out the point, which is very true, that the magazines are trying to get a more general audience. I don't think fans don't seem to be interested in the magazines like they used to be.
Because there's so much variety out there. There's more information out. I've noticed here, looking at the news, you get the Bay Area, you get the BBC here in the morning. Their news is just much more restricted than America. Just there's much less information available here. The news information, the weather information, the sports information, the immediacy. We are inundated in Western civilization, less here, but certainly much more in America, with news and information and stuff. And that's the competition for science fiction, the interest in science fiction, is just bombarded by all this stuff. And I don't think it can sustain the interest of a certain kind of person who came into fandom, who probably had glasses and was fat and didn't go into sports and things like that.
When you said she just sounded to me like you're having a nostalgic outlook of something that's gone.
Sure, it's a nostalgia. I have a nostalgia.
But like you said, like small groups, small convention, 50 people, 3 or 4 books, and magazines. That's exactly the situation in Germany. But then he describes what my reality is. But actually, I don't think that's really very heavenly. I mean, you always have these little cliques and they argue with each other.
You have much more Eastern European fandom, I know, is much more club-oriented. In fact, someone asked me that question today at my huckster table. They came by and they saw SF Chronicle, and it's very nice. What club publishes this? And I said, I publish this. And they were very surprised, because in Eastern Europe, I know especially, and I think SFCD is also, it's a whole different kind of thing. It's very much the club. It's the club is doing everything for the people.
What you said, something very generalizing, and I think the panel is just adapting to the needs of each generation or each society. So your point of view is American fandom, and not about the world, this is my conviction.
So do we just sort of let it go? I mean, I think the conventions are going to be cutting down. I think the next thing that's going to go is the conventions, because the competition for the space, the time, the facilities and hotels, we can't take it. And if, you know, you always talk about negotiating for room rates and stuff. And if the companies come in and they say, all right, sure, the $150 a night hotel, that's fine, sure. And, you know, we get the space, it's great. And the fans come in and say, well, we want the $75 a night room. And they just say, you know, screw you, we'll just, you know, take this company's offer instead. And if you can't meet anywhere. What?
It's more a problem of big conventions, I think.
No. Conventions have been frozen out of New York City. You can't have a convention in New York City. Moshe Federer down here in front looking at me, and he had a convention in New York City and got screwed on various things by the hotel. They're just too expensive, and there's just so much competition, although we have thousands of hotel rooms and stuff. All the New York area SF conventions are now held out in the suburbs, where things are cheaper, and on the weekends as well. Yes?
Yeah, one trend has been to having a lot more conventions on campuses, college campuses these days. That's one way that people are meeting the high cost. And again, I think outside of the major cities, I've noticed, you know, doing anything to my convention list, outside of the major cities, there's still lots of nooks and crannies of hotels that are in suburbia that are empty on weekends, where these smaller conventions can fit in.
But
you may have more of a New York orientation than I do.
One of the problems with conventions on the campus that I know is that when the program is over, bam, they go out. It's not a social thing at all, and there are no room parties and things like that.
Yeah, well, that's where they do get kind of satellite motels usually, where they don't have, but they get a decent room rate because they're not getting any facilities from the motel. So you go out to some motel, there is something in your house, a satellite motel 6 type place. That will get you reasonably cheap rooms, and then you rely on the campus for the meeting rooms.
But if you're 65 years old and your mobility is limited, I mean, are you willing to do this? That's the question. And that's, you know, it's just, you know, I'm putting these things out saying that I'm nostalgic for a fandom that I see as passing away. Can we, do we want to do anything to change this, these forces which are slowly but surely, I mean, we're meeting in this convention center, you know, and...
Nothing you can do, Andy, because she's right. Your book is 10 or 15 years behind us. They'll end up the same way eventually.
Yeah.
Because the truth is that fandom depends on the idea that science fiction was scorned, looked down upon literature. And now that science fiction is a mass media phenomenon, it's not going to generate persecuted feeling fans anymore. Mm-hmm. We're going to feel the need to band together against the hostile world. And you can't create that feeling artificially. 20 or 50 years from now, this won't matter anymore. We'll be just like the people who read romances and gothics and mysteries. Another.
Hey, I have a great idea. Why don't we get Saddam Hussein to endorse fandom?
Yes. I think we have to sort of put ourselves in our shoes. So it was 20 years ago, somebody told us there's going to be this huge number of SF books published, and then this great company.
Wow, the best of all possible worlds. Hey, you know. Or like, and what was Gertrude Stein? When you get there, there's no there. So that's it, you know. So here we are in Oakland, and we're not too happy here, are we? I don't know. Anything else? Is that it? Am I through? I think I'm, what? One all the way in the back. And he says...
It seems to me that some kind of partnership or interest by commercial entities, you would think that they would be interested in creating strongholds of interest in some way. And so the question would be maybe your thoughts on ways that fans or groups of fans can somehow interact with more commercial ventures to survive.
Well, it's, you know, it's true. We are talking about what can the Prozines do. The Prozines are also dying. I mean, FNSF, you know, and these other magazines are down to, like, you know, like fewer and fewer subscriptions, and the newsstand sales are shrinking away, and the books, which are actually where all the action is now, they do nothing to foster this feeling. The books should have listings of conventions and things, and the books should have listings of clubs and stuff, but they don't do it. They'd rather have, you know, ads in the back that sell, you know, the current reprinting, the current 595 reprinting of the Robert Murray Wims now.
Authors could perhaps have some input into that?
Sure. Yeah. We should maybe ask them. We should, you know, ask authors or ask SFWA to think about it, because I think SFWA perhaps would have a vested interest in maintaining this thing so that they could be guests of honor. Because if there aren't any conventions, they won't be guests of honor. And they won't have any syphilis suites, and there won't be any reason for Jerry Pernon to get drunk anymore. So, you know, it'll be the end of the world as he knew it. So. Maybe that's a good idea. I think that is a good idea. I thank you.